Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I called up Slate's Fred Kaplan to talk about how President Biden and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu got their red lines crossed. When I say that, I'm talking about how Biden has called an all-out ground invasion into the city of Rafah a red line for him, which is an assertion that Netanyahu seems to be flat-out rejecting. For Fred, the most notable thing here is that Biden drew a red line at all, because since October...
there have been no red lines. There have been no, if you take this step, we're done, or you're getting cut off.
Is that usual?
Well, this whole thing is unusual. I mean, it's not often that we're trying to apply pressure on an ally.
It was an interview on MSNBC that kicked off this latest dust-up.
What is your red line with Prime Minister Netanyahu?
This was recorded just after the State of the Union. At the time, the idea of a temporary ceasefire in Gaza seemed dead on arrival. And Israel was moving forward with that southern ground incursion, despite the fact that Rafah is crammed with more than a million refugees driven south by Israel's relentless bombing.
Would invasion of Rafah, which you have urged him not to do, would that be a red line?
It is a red line, but I'm never going to leave Israel. The defense of Israel is still critical, so there's no red line. I'm going to cut off all weapons so they don't have the Iron Dome to protect them. They don't have, but there's red lines that if it crosses, and they cannot have 30,000 more Palestinians dead.
You can hear the way this red line is a little imprecise, but it didn't matter. The message was received. Within hours, Benjamin Netanyahu had a response ready.
You know, I have a red line. You know what the red line is? That October 7th doesn't happen again. Never happens again.
And comments like this kept coming. A member of Israel's war cabinet said, ending the war without clearing out Rafah is like sending a firefighter to extinguish 80% of the fire. Then, just this week, Biden seemed to extract a small concession. He convinced Israel to send a delegation to Washington to hear out his concerns and consider an alternative plan.
It's interesting because I think if you are listening to what the far left has to say, for instance, there's talk about cutting off military support for Israel. Basically, cold stopping some form of the relationship. It seems like the opposite of what the Biden administration is doing. They're like putting themselves in the war cabinet.
Well, they kind of have to. If you go back and look at all the wars that Israel has been involved in, going back to 1948 and even before then, they have all ended because of outside pressure. And I don't think that this one is going to end without outside pressure as well, on all sides.
Today on the show, how Biden and Netanyahu arrived at this very tense standoff. And is there a way out? I'm Mary Harris. You're listening to What Next? Stick around. This episode is brought to you by Discover. When it comes to your finances, Discover wants you to know they are the credit card that is always there for you. With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, that means no more waiting for, quote, normal business hours just to get a hold of someone. We are talking real service from real people whenever you need it. Get the customer service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Fred Kaplan says before we get into this public back and forth between President Biden and Benjamin Netanyahu, it's worth considering how each man wants to resolve the situation in Gaza, what their broader goals are. Both want to free the hostages, of course. Both want to eliminate the threat of Hamas. But Joe Biden has got bigger aspirations. And that's key to understanding this impasse.
Remember, a couple months ago, there was a ceasefire that lasted 4 days. And that's where about 100 hostages were released and about 500 Palestinian prisoners. And Biden's hope, even back then, was that this could be extended. He saw this 5-day ceasefire as the beginning of a much longer ceasefire. And then as it got more and more extended, more hostages would be released, the ceasefire would continue, and then the diplomats would use the break to discuss broader issues of a peace between Israel and Palestine.
That is not how this all went down. Instead, fighting resumed, thousands died, and the death count is still spiraling. More than 1 million fled south to Rafah, a city that Israel's leader, Benjamin Netanyahu, has now promised to attack. International watchdogs are warning that famine in Gaza is imminent. But slowly, ceasefire negotiations have started up again. Biden still wants to work towards a broader lasting peace, and he's optimistic. So much so that he actually told reporters we would have a deal by March 4th. That deadline turned out to be aspirational, but Fred says it didn't come out of nowhere.
Well, look, what we know in retrospect is that the diplomats from the U.S., Qatar, and Egypt had a very detailed ceasefire deal on the table. They'd worked it out, and Saudi Arabia kind of in the background.
The idea was to have a ceasefire for Ramadan, the holiest month in the Islamic calendar.
Starting then, but lasting for 6 weeks. Then Hamas lets go 40 hostages, you know, about one a day. Israel releases 10 times as many Palestinian prisoners. There are also very detailed requirements about how much aid gets in, about how far back Israeli troops step away from cities. It seemed to be a detailed thing. And I guess maybe an assumption was that Qatar wouldn't have agreed to this if they hadn't already got buy-in from Hamas. Qatar is the main supplier, the main ally to Hamas. And it turns out they didn't because Hamas rejected it.
Huh.
So I think they thought they had a deal more than they actually did.
Top Hamas leaders said they rejected the deal because it did not offer any kind of long-term pause. It didn't fulfill their demands. Fred says regardless of who's at fault for the ceasefire going under, when it fizzled out, it was the beginning of a tonal shift from the Biden administration. On the night of his State of the Union, Biden got caught on a hot mic saying he needed to have a come-to-Jesus moment with Israel's leader. An aide came up to warn him, but Biden brushed the aide off. He said,
"Oh, it's hot. Good, good." He wanted that out there.
Yeah, exactly. Did that moment stand out to you? Was that interesting to you?
Yeah, no, that's interesting. The thing about Netanyahu that needs to be understood is that in some ways, he's a pragmatic politician and his chief goal is to stay in power. You know, Israel is a multi-party government. He was able to win previous elections by making alliances with left and center parties. This last election that he won, it was entirely with parties and entities to the right of him. If he started talking publicly about a ceasefire or even a Palestinian state, his grip on power is so tenuous. If five people dropped out of his coalition, there would have to be new elections.
That seems like a problem for the United States, who wants a long-term peace and acknowledges the necessity of a Palestinian state.
Yeah, which is why Schumer says there have to be new elections.
Let's talk about Chuck Schumer, because, you know, after this hot mic moment, last week, Chuck Schumer gives this 45-minute speech from the floor.
I rise to speak today about what I believe can and should be the path forward to secure mutual peace and lasting prosperity for Israelis and Palestinians.
And
I speak for myself.
I mean, when I read about it, it seemed like a big deal. It seemed like a big deal to you, too. Can you just lay out why? Like, what exactly was he asking for?
So Schumer, you know, just to recap a little bit, he's the Senate Majority Leader.
He's the highest ranking Jewish person in the United States.
The highest ranking Jewish political leader, yeah, ever. And he is also, I can't think of a time when he has ever criticized Israel for anything, anything.
He had spoken at AIPAC the day before this speech, right?
Yeah, and he also opposed Obama's Iran nuclear deal because Netanyahu came and said this was bad for Israel.
So a real tried and true friend of Israel, Chuck Schumer.
Tried and true, yeah. So for him to say Israel really needs new elections because Netanyahu is giving way uncritically to the far-right members of his coalition. It's impeding peace. It's not what the Israeli people even want.
He has put himself in coalition with far-right extremists like Minister Smotrich and Ben-Gavir. And as a result, he has been too willing to tolerate the civilian toll in Gaza, which is pushing support for Israel worldwide to historic lows. Israel cannot survive if it becomes a pariah.
Now, there are some things that went unreported. He also said that the Palestinian Authority needs new leadership. And without that, there won't be peace.
Mahmoud Abbas has been in charge for a long time.
Yeah. And he spent the first 10 minutes just extolling Israel and his love for Israel and his devotion to Israel.
The flowering of the Jewish people in the desert from the ashes of the Holocaust and the fulfillment of the dream of a Jewish homeland after nearly 2,000 years of praying and waiting represents one of the most heartfelt causes of my life.
You know, that gets put in the bottom paragraphs of a news story. But still, it's a big deal.
Yeah, there was a lot of focus on one line where Schumer said the Netanyahu coalition is pursuing dangerous and inflammatory policies that test existing U.S. standards for assistance.
The United States' bond with Israel is unbreakable. But if extremists continue to unduly influence Israeli policy, then the administration should use the tools at its disposal to make sure our support for Israel is aligned with our broader goal of achieving long-term peace and stability in the region.
Now, that was, to me, that was the big deal, because that's the first time that anybody has talked about a red line. And Schumer, as I say, Schumer has never made aid to Israel conditional on anything.
Is that what he's doing here? Is he calling for qualifying military aid?
He's talking about at least reassessing it. And it was interesting that Biden, while he neither endorsed nor rejected Schumer's call for this, called it a good speech.
Yeah, I mean, Chuck Schumer called for new elections in Israel. But are new elections that would theoretically remove Benjamin Netanyahu even possible?
Well, I mean, the next elections are scheduled in Israel for October of 2026. So the only way for there to be new elections is if some parts, you know, Netanyahu holds on to power by a very thin margin. If I think it's five members of his coalition quit the government, his majority collapses and there have to be new elections. The only way I think that would happen is if he took what these right-wing members of his coalition would consider excessively leftish moves.
It seems like every incentive is for Netanyahu to avoid resolving this war.
Yeah, that's the problem. That's what Schumer sees as the problem. Saudi Arabia, at one point early on, they said, yeah, we want to resume our normalizing relations with Israel, but Israel has to take concrete and irreversible steps toward creating a Palestinian state. Lately, they changed that. They just said Israel has to declare, you know, the long-term goals of a Palestinian state. Now, that should be easy to do. It doesn't tie you. There's no timetable. There's no details.
Just say the words.
Just say it. But Netanyahu won't even say that. And it's because if he did, some of his coalition members would quit, and that would be the end of his government.
After the break, how the region's other key players have a crucial role in what happens now.
If you want to understand what is happening in the United States right now, you really need to understand what's happening with the courts, the law, and the Supreme Court. The battle between democracy and whatever this cage match is that we're witnessing, it's going to be won and lost at the ballot box, but it's also going to be won and lost in the courtrooms. I'm Dahlia Lithwick. I host Slate's legal podcast, Amicus, and we are doubling our output, bringing you weekly episodes from here on in, because how else can we keep an eye on the many trials of Donald Trump, the conservative legal movement's assaults on our rights, the Supreme Court's latest slate of environmental gutting, gun safety eviscerating cases on the docket? So follow Amicus wherever you get your podcasts, new episodes dropping every Saturday morning.
I'm wondering where this kind of shifting approach to Israel and these intersecting red lines over Rafah leave us right now. You said there are like a few distinct things that have to happen to ensure any kind of lasting peace is achievable in Gaza. Can you quickly lay those out? Like, one of the key players you say is Qatar. Why?
Qatar is a really strange phenomenon. It's this tiny oil-rich country in the Gulf state. On the one hand, President Biden has officially declared them a major non-NATO ally. That's a formal declaration. It is the headquarters for the largest U.S. military base in the Middle East.
Okay, so they're a friend.
Yeah, there are joint military exercises. On the other hand, they are the chief ally and economic and military supplier of Hamas. They are the middleman in all of Hamas's negotiations with the rest of the world. And they didn't criticize Hamas even one bit for October 7th and said it was all Israel's fault. Oh, and they also house a lot of Hamas's political leaders. What, you think they're going to live in Gaza? No, they live in cushy houses and apartments in Qatar.
So you're saying Qatar needs to pick a side here?
Qatar has enormous leverage, and they have to exercise it. So that's one thing that has to happen. They have to press Hamas. They have to say, okay, unless you take this deal, we're expelling you, we're cutting off all of our aid. They have to pick a side.
Huh.
Second, the Arab Sunni countries have to go in and help rebuild Gaza. Israel doesn't have the legitimacy to go in and start, you know, conducting counterinsurgency operations, winning hearts and minds, rebuilding neighborhoods.
I mean, you can see why these countries would be chuffed at doing that. Like, they didn't destroy these buildings.
Right, right. And also, they've never wanted to help Palestinians, ever. You know, Egypt, if you looked at the Egypt-Gazan border, there is a wall 10 times higher than any wall that Israel has ever had against Gaza. They're not letting any Palestinians into the Sinai Desert they want nothing to do with Palestinians. Part of Sadat's peace treaty with Begin in the 70s was, okay, the Palestinians are your problem. We want nothing to do with it. So they have to get involved. They have to get involved. Third, and this is kind of happening already, Iran has to stay out of it. You know, Iran has all these militias, proxies all through the Middle East.
The axis of resistance. is what they're called.
Yeah, the Axis of Resistance, yeah. And as the war started, they started doing things. In fact, I think Hamas expected all the Axis to step in. They thought that Hezbollah would start pounding Tel Aviv with thousands of rockets, that Israel would be faced with a three-front war. Didn't happen. Why? Because Iran didn't want it to happen.
It's interesting because I look at your list of things that have to happen. And it seems to me like Qatar's at least in the mix of negotiating. They're saying, they have said, they will crack down more on Hamas. The regional players are also kind of like dipping their toes like into negotiating.
Right.
We have Iran, which is kind of saying like, we don't really want a big war here in the way that they're acting. So the main issue here is Israel and Netanyahu not saying we want a two-state solution or we want to explicitly have a Palestinian state.
I think I wrote in one place that we are closer than ever to a settlement of this whole problem, and yet we are also about as close as ever to this war spreading into a region-wide conflagration.
Huh.
And that's why these negotiations, which are a first step, are so crucial.
Do you think this painful fight over what happens in Rafah is bringing a resolution any closer or pushing it farther away?
Well, again, it depends what happens. I mean, let's give Netanyahu the benefit of the doubt and say he's talking about Rafah as a bargaining chip to get a ceasefire agreement really going, a serious one. Well, they have to take it. They have to do it. And if they don't, then Netanyahu's on the ball to actually go ahead and do what he wanted to do.
It's the big stick.
You know, in most wars that happen, they start out with one side or the other saying, this is going to be a cakewalk. And it's not. Especially any place where you've got not wide open battlefields, but crowded cities. And especially when you have a force like Hamas, which is deliberately built headquarters and weapons storage facilities and hideouts underneath apartments and hospitals and mosques and things like this. I mean, what has happened so far? I mean, I think Israel went way farther than they needed to, but it's from all sides. It just, no side looks great on what's going on now. And that's another reason why people who are both skeptical of Israel's aims and very supportive of them want this war to somehow come to a stop very quickly.
Fred, I'm always grateful for your time and your reporting. Thanks for coming on the show.
Anytime.
Fred Kaplan is Slate's War Stories correspondent. And that's the show. If you are a fan of what we're doing here at What Next, the best way to support our work is to join Slate Plus. Go on over to slate.com/whatnextplus to sign up. What Next is produced by Paige Osborne, Elena Schwartz, Rob Gunther, Anna Phillips, and Madeline Ducharme. We are led by Alicia Montgomery with a little boost from Susan Matthews. Ben Richmond is the Senior Director of Podcast Operations here at Slate. And I'm Mary Harris. Thanks for listening. I'll catch you back here next time.